Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to Digital Nomads, a podcast about nomadism and nomadic peoples around the world and throughout history. I'm your host, Maggie, and today I'm honored to be speaking with Dr. Carl Shook, who is a lecturer in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations at the University of Chicago, where he teaches courses on modern Middle Eastern history, the geographical and cultural logics of colonial rule and territoriality, and modern Iraq. He also advises and mentors graduate students enrolled in the University of Chicago's Center for Middle Eastern Studies and teaches a survey of Islamic history at Loyola University, Chicago. Dr. Shook's research interests are the processes and effects of imperial and colonial state building, and in particular, boundary making and governance within the borderlands of new states. He received his PhD from the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations at the University of Chicago in 2018, where his doctoral thesis, which was titled The Origins and Development of Iraq's National Boundaries, 1918 to 1932, Policing and Political Geography in the Iraq Najd and Iraq Syria Borderlands, demonstrated the importance of interactions between rural tribal populations, refugees, and provincial government officials to the formation of Iraq's modern borders. And this topic is what we'll be talking about today. So thank you so much, Carl, for joining me.
All right. And Maggie, thank you very much, too. I'm looking forward to this.
So I sort of just summarized your dissertation and your sort of research interests in my introduction there. But could you expand on that for listeners? So what were you studying, when, where, who were the kind of main actors that you were considering in your dissertation?
Yeah, so I mean, the timeline is pretty much exactly as you described it. Most of my research and case studies come out of this period from 1918 to 1932. Though, to be honest, the sorts of documents and stories I was telling really come from the early 1920s until 1927 or so. I mean, my approach to this question of boundaries and boundary making in general has been something I've been interested with, honestly, for even before I was a graduate student. But what I was particularly interested in concerning Iraq was to understand what happens before the treaties. So I want to know what happens before these sorts of final status documents and processes take place, before the map, before the League of Nations signs off on a mandate for Mesopotamia. Looking at sort of the backstory brought me to the processes of boundary making. And the people that I was studying and reading about are people who live and work in the Syrian desert, which is, you know, roughly essentially Western Iraq, Eastern Syria, just a little bit of the northern modern state of Saudi Arabia, to give us kind of some mental geography here. In general, this area, particularly in the south of Iraq, is referred to as the Shamia. And, you know, crucially, the Shamia is it's historical, it's a meaningful geographical, geological, you know, unit that is crossed by the modern state between Iraq and Saudi Arabia. But, you know, the people that I ended up encountering in the sources were provincial British forces, not sort of the bold-faced names that we're used to reading, certainly not many of the colonial elites based in Baghdad, also provincial officials, district governors of the Iraqi government, and also, and this is what really sort of grabbed my research and took it in a different direction, as most dissertation projects end up doing, are the accounts and the discourse and the relationship of these officials to the Bedouin tribes and sheikhs living in this transnational zone, or soon to be transnational zone, of northern Arabia and the Syrian desert. So with all of these players in the field, you know, literally responding to historical forces, attempting to determine what this new political order meant for them and their lives and their livelihoods, you know, I came at these questions with a couple different approaches. One of them was to look at borders as a process that involves these human figures and not as static institutions, certainly not lines on a map, or even worse, lines in the sand, if you want to go that far. You know, I understand borders as a process beginning from the process of just imagining, projecting out, you know, loose understandings of territorial and social difference onto a landscape like, let's say, historical Mesopotamia. But then during negotiations and sort of the mechanisms of day-to-day rule and governance, again, before maps and borders are demarcated or even delimited, we're a long way from border posts being laid down in the desert and strict surveys being made of this work. And then working in this borderland as I was, this fit with another one of my goals, which was to decenter these state-centric narratives about state building, and in particular, a state-centric historiography about the origins of modern Iraq. In short, you know, these denizens of the borderland that I was speaking about and I ended up working on in my research have agency, and through cooperation, through resistance, I argue they're able to shape, if not the final locations of the boundaries, they're able to shape the nature of those boundaries going forward. And I think we see this in the kind of piecemeal nature of Iraq's boundaries. Each of them, if we just take a western boundary, the southern boundary with Najd, the boundary with Syria, the boundary with the Ottoman state, and then Turkey, all develop on their own terms, specific to the historical and local circumstances.
Your dissertation focuses on the British occupation and the British mandate, but obviously they were kind of replacing or saw themselves as replacing the Ottoman Empire in this region. So backing up a bit, how did the Ottoman Empire conceive of and control this desert frontier region and its inhabitants? And to what extent were the British engaging with Ottoman traditions? What aspects, you know, did they maintain, and what aspects did they change from Ottoman patterns of rule?
Yeah. So where I've come down on this question is, I think that, you know, as the British occupy, you know, Ottoman Iraq in 1914, and afterwards, they arrived, you know, on the scene in agreement through their own processes in history, but more or less in agreement with the social division of Iraq's people. And also they agreed with a division of Iraq's physical geography as one of agrarian, an area with agrarian potential, i.e., you know, some place that parts of it that are irrigable and can support agrarian life, and then the desert. So there's these two strict kind of binaries. Now, the British, I think, through their own sort of discursive history, agree with these ideas. So there's some agreement with the Ottoman approach. But what they actually inherit is a structure, a set of governing institutions, which are built on very similar basis. Let's take this back to the question of like how the Ottomans view things. I mean, the Ottoman perspective on, you know, what is now, you know, modern day Iraq is an idea that, I mean, one of their divisions is that urban society or settled society and culture is superior to rural or unsettled people. So there again, there's this binary between settled peasants and settled tribes who are engaged or part of sort of an agrarian system of production. And in Iraq, certainly the Bedouin. The Bedouin in the Ottoman perspective were seen as a disruptive force in at least two senses. First, they were disruptive to the settled agrarian-based society, these systems of production and, you know, sort of export of agricultural goods. And this occurred through raiding, predation of settled communities by Bedouin populations, and also through the competition for grazing land. So this is bad for farmers, right? So this reduces tax receipts for the Ottoman treasury. It, you know, might force peasants off of the land, which again is to the detriment of agricultural production and the tax base. And it also disrupts regional trade networks, right, through the threatening, through the targeting of shipment routes and some of the more local caravan routes. So this is one way in which nomadic peoples were seen as disruptive. The other issue is that, again, in general, Bedouin societies being mobile and relatively militarily proficient and somewhat independent and self-sufficient, this means that they are less easy to govern, and they remain a liability to models of centralized government. There's a quote from an Ottoman official. He's in Basra, so southern Iraq, in 1880. He reports back that, quote, since only 10% of the population in his area, right, was settled, then only 10% of the population is under governmental authority, right? So there's this idea that anyone living as a Bedouin is beyond our reach. The Ottomans continuously attempt to settle and bring Bedouin populations under control. We see this as part of this broader, you know, set of governing reforms under the Tanzimat policies of the mid-19th century. Changes to the land law, for example, you know, created tax incentives, provided land use rights or ownership rights to sheikhs and others who were willing to settle down and, you know, give up their nomadic lifeways. And in general, the goal was to get Iraq's tribes, and especially the Bedouin, to move from being sort of a net cost on the state, both in literal terms and in just the effort required to govern, and bring them into the kind of tax-producing society. I mean, one final note about the Ottoman view of things is, now, the British enter Iraq in 1914 at the head of the Persian Gulf. They land at Fao, and they quickly move up the Shatt al-Arab to Basra. And their main goal for being there is to secure or to provide sort of a regional sort of force in case the Suez Canal to the west in Egypt comes under attack, and also to maintain access to the oil fields of south western Iran in Hejaz. Of course, that oil by 1914 is being pumped out of the ground and moved to Muhammara and the onto the Shatt al-Arab, processed. And shortly before this, of course, one of the important backstories is, you know, not only is the Persian Gulf and thus the Indian Ocean, of course, important to sort of Britain's position on the world stage, but they have recently transitioned their naval fleet from coal to oil. So this is integral. Incidentally, oil in Iraq's oil reserves have been, you know, surveyed to an extent. There is an idea that it is there. But in my opinion, in 1914, and even for some years after that, Iraq's oil reserves itself are not so much the issue. But anyway, this Ottoman world that they come into is made up of three provinces. Starting from the south, we have the province of Basra, which is kind of oriented towards the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean sphere. There's the province of Baghdad, and then the province of Mosul, which borders Syria and sort of the and Anatolia. And all of them are on this, are part of the Tigris and the Euphrates River Valley and drainage system. So when the British arrive, one of their first goals is to sort of bring a government kind of up and running as quickly as possible. They're an occupying force. You know, until 1918, they are at war with the Ottoman government in Iraq. And this leads to a couple things. I think it's important to point out first that the British are familiar with Ottoman Iraq already through a century of produced knowledge, firsthand experience, represented in maps, ethnographies, travelogues, and this sort of thing. People traveling in the region, surveyors, sometimes in the employ of the Ottoman government itself, archaeologists are part of this knowledge production about not just the landscape of Iraq, but also its peoples. There are commercial officials and representatives active, you know, participating in concessions, for example, for shipment on the Euphrates and the Tigris at this time. There are naval officers who are there as part of this concession. Everyone involved in the oil industry, you know, working out of, based on the Shatalada and in southwest Iran. There are Indian soldiers, you know, British Indian soldiers who are escorting a pilgrim from India to cities like Najaf and Karbala as well. And then, of course, there's the military, the British military hub in Kuwait. So there is knowledge about Iraq as a place and its people. There's also ideas about what Iraq is, sort of historical. So there's this, you read the sources, and this is everyone from travelers to British governors, British administrative officials, talking about Mesopotamia's, the term, their decline and fall, right? It's the site of, even from a Christian point of view, right? You can draw back to the origin of mankind. There's a man named William Wilcox who purported to discover, for example, the Garden of Eden, using, you know, sort of like drainage or surveys of water courses and flood zones and things like this. But there's this idea that from the Abbasid period, certainly after Baghdad's sacking of by the Mongols in 1258, that the Ottoman state that succeeded them eventually had been unable to sort of restore Iraq to its civilizational glory, to its golden age. They also hold that the people who live here in this, in Mesopotamia, again, this is the British, you know, sort of perspective, is that settled populations are, in a sense, more civilized than nomadic peoples. And then we have the physical geography, and then we have these, or I would essentially say, narrative-driven or Orientalist understandings of the sort of Iraqis, you know, population. And these get mapped onto each other. So we get these cultural judgments about settled and unsettled environments and the people who live there. So, for example, Gertrude Bell writes about the Euphrates Valley as, you know, being an inexhaustible fertility, right? As sort of the core, the beating heart of Iraq. And then this is, you know, very much in opposition to the arid desert, right? The uplands up out of the river valleys. There's a geographer, John Lorimer, who's responsible for, you know, some of the really substantial collections of ethnographic and geographical information at the time. He also sees, you know, Iraq as being at its core, it's the Tigris and Euphrates River Valley. And you read through these, his gazetteer, and it's clear that he and other people are not really sure what to do about the desert, right? The Syrian desert, the Arabian desert. They're not sure what to do about the Bedouin who live there. Are they part of Mesopotamian history and culture? Ultimately, they come down to yes, but they are a liability and they will require very particular kinds of governance to make it work.
Okay, so you talked a bit about why the British were in Iraq in the first place, and obviously one of the primary reasons being oil. But you also said that that is possibly not the main reason, in your opinion, or that there were other reasons that the British had this kind of investment in Iraq. Can you talk a bit about what those other reasons were?
I mean, Iraq's, the value of Iraq as an oil producing state or site, I guess we should say, begins very quickly. And by the end of the mandate, you know, there are joint initiatives and projects for exploiting oil around to create Mosul, for example. But in 1914, and this continues, I think, really through at least the mid-1920s, the agenda of the British in, you know, Ottoman Iraq is to maintain and secure their trade networks in the Indian Ocean sort of sphere, right? The coast of East Africa, India, and the Persian Gulf, and of course, Egypt. Oil is also, you know, integral, as we mentioned, coming out of, you know, southwest Iran. And then there's sort of laying on top of this is a transit or communication corridor linking Britain and Europe and the Mediterranean with India. Now, for a time, most of this travel, most of this communication occurs, comes through the Suez Canal. There are sort of there are local, or let's say regional, concerns, but then there's also specific aspects of Ottoman Iraq's makeup. And what I think was underappreciated in, you know, sort of the list or the considerations of Iraqi or of the British occupation of Iraq is the value that they placed on Mosul province, not necessarily as an oil producing province, but in the context of an ongoing war with the Ottoman Empire, which continued into the early 1920s. Each of Iraq's provinces was seen as sort of a domino. The understanding was that if Mosul falls, then Baghdad will fall. And if Baghdad province falls, then Basra province and Britain's sort of foothold in the Persian Gulf will be under threat as well.
Can you just clarify a little bit what the situation is like in the sort of early 1920s as far as Iraq's national borders, especially with like the Nejd? Like, what are the treaties or the protocols that have already been formed to create and govern these borders? Who are the actors that are involved in creating these borders?
Yeah, absolutely. So by 1922, when we see the first sort of agreements penned to paper between the British Mandate authorities in based in Baghdad and Ibn Saud of Nejd, we have, as I've alluded, we have a mandate. So we have this mandate system established in 1920. And in short, the mandate system has allowed the British Empire and the French to maintain a presence, an active presence in these ex-Ottoman lands. So the French are in Syria, Greater Syria, Syria and Lebanon. The British are in Palestine, Transjordan, and Iraq. Now, there are technical requirements to being a mandate power. And the essence is that the British and the French are here to assist sort of indigenous governments in Iraq and Syria, for example, until they are able to stand on their own. Literally, that's in the text of the League of Nations Charter, right? Until they're able to stand on their own and as independent nations. In Iraq, this mandate is never put into place for reasons we don't really have time to get into today. The British want more autonomy. They essentially don't want to be limited by the terms of the mandate. They want to stay longer, and they want to have a more robust military presence in Iraq, basically. So they enact a series of Anglo-Iraqi treaties, and each of these kind of follows the previous one, and this is what really governs and shapes Britain's role in Iraq. But some sort of state building still needs to happen. And whether you are a mandate in technical terms or in spirit, this means recognizable sovereign borders. You know, before we get into these, just into the sort of the development of these borders themselves, I think it's important to point out that the British dominate the process of border formation. The Iraqi state, the monarchy of Faisal I, right, one of these Hashemite kings, is part of the process, but the British, and most importantly, British security concerns, really dominate this process. So there are a couple agreements in play. They both date to 1922, and these are agreements with Ibn Saud, who is the leader of this sort of nascent Saudi state. These agreements, they have geographical aspects to them. If you look at the maps produced in these meetings and coming out of these negotiations, they are maps of the Shamia, and there are lines on them, and you see a proposed neutral zone, this little flattened diamond shape that you see on some early maps of Iraq. You see different proposals for Kuwait's boundaries. But what's really at stake in these agreements in these 1922 treaties is sort of a more effective and social idea of territorial governance. So here the focus is twofold. One is to identify, really for the first time in this context, which tribes belong to, and this is again their term, which tribes belong to Nejd, and are therefore the responsibility of the Bin Saud. And then, of course, which tribes are, quote unquote, Iraqi tribes. And the way that this is done is the territories, the seasonal territories of each of these tribes, along with some information about where they are purported to spend, you know, their time when they need to water animals at fixed wells. This information is kind of tabulated and a rough map is drawn up of where these tribes are most of the time. And then through these inevitably sort of overlapping territories, or the term in Arabic is dira, a straight line is proposed, right? That more or less best divides these up. So this is one focus of the UKAIR and the Bahra agreements from 1922. And then the other is to settle the question, a political question really, between mainly the British and Ibn Saud, as to what this frontier zone will look like, and particularly what state authority will look like in this frontier zone. So there are, at this point, within this document, you see prohibitions against sort of the hardening or the building up of military installations, police forces within literally the vicinity of the border. The fact that everybody has their own idea of what the vicinity of the border is leads to some problems later on. But that's really that sets the tone for Iraq's southern border and its relationship with Ibn Saud. This recognition that there is no firm border, but there are certain tribes that are in one way or another associated with each state, and sort of the technical terms of how to essentially form a boundary regime, right? How, as two neighboring states, how do we cooperate? How do we, in effect, work together to make this border meaningful for the people who live there?
So you've alluded quite a bit already to the Bedouin practice of intertribal raiding, and that this was sort of a practice or behavior that the Ottomans really kind of wanted to control or to eliminate. And then it seems like in this post-Ottoman period, it's again something where the imperial powers that be also perceived this practice as a threat to their territorial sovereignty. Can you talk a little bit about what is intertribal raiding actually in the first place? When people say that, what does that actually refer to? And what did it mean, and how did it function in a sort of Bedouin social or economic context? And then how did the British in this case perceive it? Why was it such a threat to sort of British security?
Yeah, so in the sort of a political vacuum, this intertribal raiding is the sort of the predation, the acquisition of material goods, stock, animals between one tribe and another. So how this works is the members of a particular clan or a tribe, sometimes in a strategic or even temporary alliance with another clan or tribe, will target either yet another tribe, a third party, their camps, their flocks. They might also target the caravans of merchants. They might target settled community, agricultural outposts, this sort of thing. I think it's important to note that this is not for purposes of territorial conquest. And it's not political, except in the sense that a tribe's prestige or the legitimacy of a particular leader is going to be enhanced by their ability to either successfully raid and thus provide, for the material wealth of their community, or the other side of that coin, able to, defend oneself and one's tribe. So, intertribal raiding in the Bedouin sense is mainly for purposes of enrichment, to acquire the necessary material wealth, raw materials, the animals. Sometimes prisoners are taken and ransomed, but what they share in common is it is a part of an economy of a kind. The purpose is not territorial. These can be very violent acts, but murder is not part of the purpose. I mean, Bedouin life can be very insecure. Bedouin, like all nomads, are we know that they are very much integrated into, you know, settled economies and lifeways and cultures. There is an interdependence there where we see nomadic or pastoralist populations like really flourishing. But it can be difficult. And in particular, the dependence upon animal husbandry means that environmental conditions sort of require alternative sources of supplementing one's flocks and one's livelihood. So this is in general kind of the why we see the development and the continuation, the perpetuation of these intertribal raiding.
Yeah, I think there's also this, like you mentioned, there is this etiquette to intertribal raiding that we don't really, that we wouldn't necessarily kind of think of as existing. Like you said, murder isn't allowed. There are all these kind of rules that govern this practice that make it quite controlled in its own way and kind of internally controlled. I was reading this report a while ago by a British official who was interviewing a Bedouin sheikh about raiding. And he asked the sheikh, why do you guys raid each other? You know, why do you need to do this? And allegedly the sheikh says, why do you British people play football? There's that like kind of cultural aspect to it as well.
Yeah. I mean, even in that conversation, right, there's, you know, I kind of off the cuff mentioned at the beginning, like, you know, in a sort of a vacuum. But what I really meant was in a particular context in which this Bedouin lifeway is more or less, you know, stable. Like, you know, you're exactly right. And you see the way that raiding filters down and permeates and becomes part of a Bedouin sense of self and identity, you know, the stories, the maintenance of, you know, kinship ties, the saliency of, you know, clan and tribal networks. So what happens in the beginning of the 20th century when conditions are very different? So in the mandate, the mechanics, the reasons, the motivations for intertribal raiding is more or less the same. But there are now a couple new factors. One is that through the politicization of partly of territory in the way that the UKAIR agreements, for example, between the British and Ibn Saud put political label on certain tribes, but also in the way that the British, you know, the Iraqis, but also the governments of Transjordan, the French in Syria are claiming territory. This adds a political level to intertribal raiding. And it's at this point that raiding really becomes an issue for the British and for the process of Iraqi state building. And it's this conflict between tribes in what becomes the borderland that we see the sort of the Bedouin sort of role in the development of Iraq's borders.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
On that note, there's this episode that you wrote about in your dissertation that I found really interesting, where this conflict over cross-border raiding essentially arises between Ibn Saud and the Ikhwan. And maybe you can explain also in a second who the Ikhwan were on one side and the Iraqi government and the British on the other, where they're this kind of conflict arises over what you were alluding to earlier, actually, this kind of perceived militarization of the border region that is supposed to be a neutral zone. There arises this misunderstanding over what does it mean to build kind of military installations in this region? What does it mean to be in the vicinity of the border? These kind of particularities of the treaty that you were referring to previously. Can you unpack that conflict a little bit?
Yeah. So there is ostensibly a treaty between, you know, Ibn Saud and the British that, you know, prevents the development of the borderland. And I think this speaks to, in one regard, to a British idea of state building, and one that Ibn Saud more or less acquiesced to, that the border can be developed in stages. There's very much this understanding that first we will establish sort of the terms of governance. Sometimes these terms are established through, you know, a treaty negotiation, and sometimes they're established through facts on the ground. And in this case, you know, that you're alluding to, we see both. We see these parallel approaches by the British and the Iraqi government to some extent to both honor the agreement with Ibn Saud, mainly for the purposes of avoiding open conflict with him. Especially the British have a long-term investment in Ibn Saud as the ruler of Najd. And at one point, you know, during the height of this border war in 1927 and 1928 between Iraq and the Ikhwan, there's just this reminder, it's like, okay, like, do not let this derail our relationship with Ibn Saud. Like, this is literally a sideshow. So there's this concern about, you know, sort of the technical aspects of building an internationally recognized state. But the British were also really experts in Iraq, and you see this in the case with the Iraqi border with Syria as well, of creating facts on the ground. And for the British, this meant the gradual extension of security infrastructure out from the, you know, if you imagine southern Iraq, we have, you know, the Shatt al-Arab waterway runs from the head of the Persian Gulf northwards through Basra. And then where it splits with the Tigris, it runs more or less east-west for a while, sort of parallel with the frontier with Najd. And out of this sort of riparian zone where there are roads, there are villages, there is, you know, sort of the infrastructure of government, there extends gradually through lots of different processes over the early and mid 1920s, roads, air patrol routes, wireless radio stations, and all the sorts of maps and intelligence that goes with it. Now, what this sort of penetration of the frontier involves is twofold. Its main focus is on maintaining security in this area against raids coming from Najd. But the reason they're doing this, because much of the British, their vision, and I think they were largely correct, of how to legitimate their power was through the prestige accumulated from demonstrating an ability to protect Iraq's tribes. And again and again in the sources, the colonial sources anyway, there's this concern for the loss of prestige, the loss of face, a fear that Iraq's tribes would see the British as a insufficient or incapable partner in protecting them. And then the argument goes, if they lose the respect of these tribal populations, they would face revolt and they would possibly face the loss of Iraq. So they are steadily increasing their presence in southern Iraq, in this area of the Shamia. It's not consistent. It's not smooth. It literally depends on the season. A lot of these kind of these far-flung posts are not sustainable through the middle of the summer. But gradually over time, they build a network of posts. These are places where tribes will check in. They often relate them to caravan routes or wells in attempt to hijack the hubs of Bedouin life as a way to present these populations with government authority. It's a chance to interview sheikhs, collect intelligence on the goings on in the area, both within southern Iraq and in northern Arabia, in Najd. So in 1927, there are sort of several sort of outposts along this stretch of in southern Iraq, and they sort of sweep up in a northwesterly direction from the Euphrates, sort of in parallel with the modern, with the present day boundary of the Iraqi-Saudi border. In 1927, there's a decision to supplement the police force and build up an outpost at a place called Busaya. There's some wells there. This is a watering hole, basically. And to hear the British say it, this is just a humble fort. It's a little mud hut, no big deal. They tell Ibn Saud that it's purely defensive in nature, right? This is not should not be seen as sort of an incursion or, encroachment upon the boundary. There's this back and forth about what counts as in the vicinity of, a callback to this rather vague language from their original treaty. But in a sense, it's exactly what the British do, for example, in extending the boundary around to the west of Jebel Sinjar. Are up in Syria, as opposed to, kind of striking right through the desert. They are creating facts on the ground by leveraging their superior security apparatus. And it's actually not Ibn Saud who ends up taking action against this outpost. It's the son of the Mutair Sheikh, who is actually has been in sort of a low-key on-again, off-again revolt against Ibn Saud. It's actually these members of the Ikhwan, the Mutair tribe, who attack this fort at Busaya. And it is not a case of tribal raiding against a site. It is a military attack, and most of the military and civilian staff at this post at Busaya are killed. So this immediately calls for a response from the British and from the Iraqi point of view. A strong, sort of military response is required. It begins what's known as the Ak Force campaign. But notably, the British do not want to come into conflict with Ibn Saud. And despite some pretty mealy-mouthed apologies by Ibn Saud, that he just didn't know anything about this and he had no idea it was coming, they agree not to press the point. Again, we want to keep our eye on the ball, keep people like Ibn Saud in control as our regional partners. But it does provide the excuse, the opportunity to launch 4 or 5 month campaign in southern Iraq against the Ikhwan, really as a reaction to this raid.
And so what are some of the other long-term consequences of this whole crisis? Does this lead to, going forwards, the kind of increased militarization of the border? How does this play into some of the later treaties that were signed between the British and Ibn Saud?
Yeah, I think it's essential. I think this hardening of the boundaries in this kind of step-by-step manner is what makes possible the final delimitation and demarcation of the boundary in the 1930s. I've mentioned this, several times in other sort of capacities, but it really is kind of stunning that so much of what the British projected or sought as territorial limits of Mandate Iraq actually held and were obtained after, in some cases, decades of governance and negotiation and work. And I think by looking at these sorts of specific localized events, we can see the work that goes into reifying and propping up these projections of state power. There was at the time a lot of hand-wringing over whether or not rebuilding a place like Busaya was worth it, right? Because it had just kicked off this pretty significant conflict. Again, there was worry about angering Ibn Saud, or even worse, convincing Ibn Saud to take the gloves off and let the Ikhwan up into Iraq as sort of a proxy resistance force against the British. But in effect, the networks, again, the air routes, the fuel supply, the fuel dumps for airplanes, the guard posts that were established all the way up to the Jordanian border never went away. And every year, Iraqi police and British soldiers would be restationed. And every year, the tracks and the landing strips get a little more smoothed out and a little more built up. They all attain, after a while, a permanent site on the map as a de facto border station. I mean, it's important to remember that none of them are on the border. They can't even see the border from where they are. You know, they're, you know, 40, 50, 60 miles at least from the border. But they are de facto border points because border enforcement at this time is still very much about the enforcement and the limitations on the movement of Bedouin. So you don't need to be at the border because that's not really what is at stake. But this, I mean, again, I would hold that this enables the delimitation of these boundaries and these final status talks, because there's really no other option. Facts on the ground have been established by the time a final treaty is established with Ibn Saud about not just the boundaries of Iraq, but also Transjordan. Both Ibn Saud has been recognized as the, you know, undisputed sovereign of Nejd by the British, and he has his own network of de facto border posts, again, reaching all the way up towards the Jordanian border. And we have the development of a, if not always effective, a recognizable boundary or border regime, where you have two sovereign or two governing entities, two states working with each other over the common goal of a boundary. They don't always agree on its exact specificities, but the new political order has carried the day, and its recognition is really integral to the success and the legitimacy of both the British in Iraq and of Ibn Saud in his new kingdom.
Okay. And so what are some of the long-term consequences for the Bedouin of these new borders? You know, we talked about raiding and the part of the goal of the borders and the security installations around them was to eliminate this practice of tribal raiding. Were there other instances that you came across in your research of how these borders changed or forced the adaptation of Bedouin lifestyles to adapt to this new security system?
Yeah, well, another case that I'm actually doing kind of further work on now involves a similar sort of two groups of tribes in the Syrian desert who are similar to what we saw in southern Iraq, but this time through coordination between the British and the French in Syria, is the identification of we have Syrian tribes, we have Syrian Bedouin, and we have Iraqi Bedouin. And in one case, we have two groups of the same tribe, right? A set of clans belonging to the same tribe in Iraq and Syria, who are identified as Syrian and Iraqi. And there's a lot of sort of discursive work over how, well, you know, the French talking about how their tribes are much more settled and civilized and they're all towing the line. And it's their, you know, British or it's their Iraqi, you know, brothers, basically, who refuse to recognize this new political order. And the tribes people in Iraq are doing the same thing, right? No, it's the Syrians who keep crossing the border and bothering us. But this is an example of where each of these clans, we have the division of a tribe by a border, and each of them, the leaders of both groups relatively quickly align themselves with the interests of Iraq and Syria. And this is what is, you know, particularly interesting. The British use this as a way to sort of govern the border, because now border disputes are not between them and the French, but it's between different tribes. So they kind of insulate themselves through the use of these, you know, tribal shura councils. So when there's conflicts about border crossing and raids and things like this, they shroud it in the system of, you know, of tribal justice, and kind of are able to keep their hands clean, make it look as if it's not this political project of establishing facts on the ground. The French and the British assign jobs to these tribes. They are given the mandate to patrol the border. They're armed. They're given stipends, and they are given the mission to patrol the boundary, to protect and escort travel along the road between Baghdad or Mosul and Aleppo and Damascus. And likewise with the Syrian faction. They are also given positions of, you know, these quasi-official roles in the governance, the policing of their population. I mean, it's been written that the border means that for some, you know, merchants become smugglers if there's a border there, and, you know, raiders become tax collectors. So the manner in which Bedouin populations and their sheikhs recognize the new sort of systems and logics at work across the sort of the mandate world is unceasingly fascinating in the way that they become part of the governing apparatus and become ultimately part of the states of, you know, in this case, Iraq and Syria.
Yeah, I mean, in the context that I'm more familiar with, which is Jordan, we see the same phenomenon occurring as well, where the Bedouin are tasked with essentially being policemen of the border region. But then over the years, this evolves into this elite status of the Bedouin within the Jordanian military and politics. So definitely through this process, we get this kind of incorporation of the Bedouin into the modern nation state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So maybe just a final question for you about maybe the longer term consequences of this process that you research. And I understand this is not sort of your area of expertise mm-hmm. anymore, but just thinking about the kind of modern geopolitics of this region, do you see consequences of these border-making processes playing out today? Do you see any ways in which the effects of British and Saudi decisions and Iraqi decisions that were made a century ago, do you see any ways in which these kind of reoccur in contemporary politics?
Yeah, I mean, my own observations is that, you know, many of these boundaries, particularly the boundaries that, you know, that I study between Iraq with Saudi Arabia and Iraq with Syria, remain for a whole host of reasons. It's not a perfectly straight line. But remain relatively sort of isolated and both literally and, you know, sort of functionally distant from centralized authority in Iraq. We see this with the reliance on tribal levies during Iraq's, you know, war against Islamic State. You know, I mean, this is happening in Syria as well. Also, the logics, the practice of, or the this continued goal of an absolute or sort of hard border. So there is, as of, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, there is a border fence between Iraq and Saudi Arabia. You know, this is also a response, you know, ostensibly to Islamic State. And I think there's certainly a place to discuss the rhetorical and political value of building fences and walls with your neighbors. I don't think that's unique to this case. It's certainly not unique to, you know, the United States' portrayal of the border with Mexico. But what does, you know, interest me with this border fence is that if the goal is to prevent, from the Saudi point of view, if the goal is to prevent Islamic State terrorists from infiltrating Saudi Arabia from Iraq, when does that fence come down? When does this boundary become, you know, in effect softer, right? I don't think it will. These boundaries tend to harden and calcify over time. And I don't see that sort of priority and that vision of, or that goal changing. So in a similar way to the Akforce campaign and this war against the Ikhwan of the Mutair tribe in the middle and late 1920s, where the result is a militarized southern desert in Iraq. I think the legacy of this fence, the border fence between Iraq and Saudi Arabia is going to last long, much longer than let's say the acute terror threat of, you know, ISIS fighters. I mean, what interests me, and I've done, you know, no real sort of research on this, but what interests me is the next step or the effect that that has on the way that states think about their neighbors, think about their borders. Because it, as the nature of the border changes, I think the nature of the polity that it encompasses and purports to protect changes as well.
Well, on that pessimistic note, I think we could end it there. Thank you so much for joining me and for sharing your research with us. That was really interesting.
All right. Thank you as well. I enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you for listening. And of course, special thanks to Dr. Carl Shook for coming on to talk to me. I'll post some links and images and further resources related to the content of this episode on my Twitter at @nomads_pod. So please check that out if you're interested. You can also contact me there or by email at digitalnomadspod@gmail.com. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, or if there's a topic you'd like me to cover in the future. Thanks so much for listening.